Imagine you're driving down endless aisles in a packed office parking lot looking for a spot. The minutes are ticking away and your chances of getting to work on time are diminishing by the second. Then, there it is, the perfect spot. Your boss is never going to know that you pressed that snooze button a few extra times this morning. But as you're turning into the spot, to your surprise, hidden between two cars is a little Prius right where you wanted to park. You just want to scream as your seemingly endless hunt continues. Now, imagine you arrive at work, you get out of your car at the office entrance, you then wave goodbye to your car, and it goes off on its own to hunt for a spot. This could be you sooner than you might think. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, the VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives here at Siemens Digital Industry Software. And today's podcast marks the start of our new series called Women Driving the Future, where we will talk to the women leading our industry forward. On our first episode of the series, we are speaking with Anuja Sonarkar. She is the CEO of Steer Tech, about autonomy and everyone's least favorite part of driving, parking. Now, Steer is revolutionizing the parking experience by creating what you could call an autonomous valet and thus ensuring that the next generation of drivers will never need to learn how to park. Anuja and I will discuss how to make your existing car an autonomous parking machine, what it will take to reach a driverless future, and how Steer is handling the typical aggressive drivers of our modern Wild West, otherwise known as the parking lot. Welcome to the show, Anuja.
Thank you so much, Ed. It's such a pleasure to be here. I really am so looking forward to this podcast.
If you're someone that likes to drive, the driving part is the good part. And then at the end, when driving's all done, it's time to park. And I think that Steer Tech is going to do something to make that parking experience better by just eliminating it altogether. Is that right?
Yes, to put it that way. Yes, absolutely. We want to change the whole experience of getting from point A to point B upside down. And really, we want to disconnect yourself and what you want to do from what your car has to do.
How'd you get to Steer Technology? You're one of the founders. What were you doing before, and how did you get the whole idea about making an autonomous, shall we call it, car valet?
I come from almost two decades of building secure communication systems for extremely adversarial tactical environments, what we call cybersecurity in today's parlance. My PhD is in distributed system security in wireless mobile ad hoc networks. And I've predominantly worked for the defense industry. In 2011, I got the chance of a lifetime to work on cutting-edge frontier technologies at Battelle. And that led me to automotive. And my background lent itself very well to automotive communication networks, you know, distributed, low-power, low-resource systems that were so vulnerable, open as the county fairs, I tell you. And it was the early days of automotive cybersecurity industry, and my team and I ended up building the world's first intrusion detection system for cars with Six Sigma accuracy. And that technology was transitioned to Honeywell, into the armored vehicle program. And then I moved on to another startup in a similar but slightly different space. And again, we happened to be right place, right time with what I call the summer of 2015, the great Jeep Cherokee hack. And that hack, where a Jeep Cherokee was hacked on a highway and driven into a ditch, was really a game changer in the automotive industry. We happened to be a company that had a technology that could stop an attack like that. And so one thing led to another, and we were very quickly acquired by Harman in January of 2016. So at that point, I transitioned my responsibilities and started deeply thinking about what I wanted to do next.
Was that the last time that there was a hijacking like that? Was it that your technology that's kept that from happening again?
Well, it was the last time that a public demonstration of that kind of a high profile happened. After that, the same team tried to do some more hacks, but they were incremental in nature. And by then, the point really was taken by the auto industry that it doesn't matter what make or model your car is, they're all vulnerable. And it's not one is more vulnerable than another. It's just that these systems have been designed in a manner where they are sometimes over-engineered for future reasons, or sometimes because the mindset of the designers and the engineers is not about what can somebody else do with it. So that's what was the predominant goal that people took away, and that cybersecurity is a real threat. It affects your bottom line, and we have to do something about it.
And so then somehow you go from cybersecurity to autonomous parking. It seems like a natural transition.
Well, I have a very particular set of skills. And I know Liam Neeson said that first in Taken, but it's true. I go in to very adversarial environments and figure out what is available and what I can use and what can I build my solution using, and leveraging first what I have, what I can securely source from the environment. And then I add what's needed to get the goal achieved. So this has helped me build, you know, some of the secure communication systems that were deployed in the Tora Bora caves and in Afghanistan, and some projects that I can't even talk about. But this is something that is a very unique skill set. And in security, we say don't over-engineer, because anything extra that you leave in there for your benefit is there for your adversary to use as well. So in my experience, in working very, very closely in securing automotive systems, made me realize that these systems are actually very capable, more capable than what they are being designed to use for. And this additional capability can be leveraged legitimately to build and realize autonomous vehicles today itself. You don't need to add so much expensive hardware, so many expensive sensors, so many expensive computing modules to do things. When you actually look at these cars, and there are so many resources available here already, that if you design the purpose correctly, you have almost everything that is needed already available, and very little is needed incrementally. And that I can design in and add in, which is what is Steer's philosophy in autonomous vehicle design, retrofitting an existing vehicle to go autonomous.
It seems, though, that you can become more successful if you limit the domain within which this autonomous vehicle has to operate. For instance, low-speed parking versus an autonomous vehicle that has to run on a city street and avoid the bouncing ball and the child running out onto the road or whatever it might be. Isn't that a big part of how you approach engineering?
100% correct. When I said, you know, when you design the purpose correctly, hidden in that is to slice really the problem into verticals, if you may call, segments that are mutually exclusive, in the sense that you can do different things in those verticals and they can coexist. And if you look at the autonomous vehicle space, a level 5 autonomous car that knows it all and can do it all is really at least a decade and a half out, because the complexities are so huge. They are just, you cannot control so many environmental variables, human factors in the mix there, other vehicles, environment, climate. But if you divided it up very smartly into highway autopilot or autonomous shuttle or low speed navigation, then you can actually reduce the size of the problem space that you are trying to solve for. And now the solution you're creating can fit that space better.
So tell us a little bit about your system and how it works. I'm pulling up with my car, my favorite restaurant, and I get out of the car. Then what happens?
So the level 4 autonomous parking, we call it automated valet parking. You basically pull up to your place of interest, let me call it that, and to a restaurant. And when you open your Steer app, it will tell you that there is an autonomous vehicle parking zone here. And so it will navigate you to the drop-off area where you can drop yourself off. And so as a human driver, you drop yourself off to a loading zone. You pull up and you exit your vehicle, and you're into the restaurant. You press your app button to go park your vehicle. It's going to do a series of safety checks each and every time to make sure that car is good to go, has enough gas to make the round trip, and you know all the sensors looking good. And then it downloads what is called the mission goal. So it knows where the parking zone is, where it can go park, and it's going to calculate how it can get there. It's going to drive on those private roads, and it's going to get into the parking area, and then it's going to dynamically look for a first available suitable spot for the vehicle and pull itself in. And it's going to let you know, hey, I'm parked. You just saved yourself X minutes or whatever while you're enjoying your dinner. And you come out, you summon your vehicle, and the car does the reverse maneuver. It's going to pull out, and it's going to come back to pick you up from the designated pickup area.
So could it also find, say, a spot on a road? Is that a possibility too, parking like right on a city street, for instance? Or does it have to be a parking lot, say, that's been properly defined and put into your system?
It can do all of the above, but there is an order to the rollout. So what we're doing currently is over time, we will unlock all these different capabilities. But what we're doing, we're starting with private lots, private spaces. And so you drive yourself into that private space or an adjoining, say, like a mall or somewhere that has these private lots all around the mall. You drive yourself there and then you let the car go autonomous. Street parking is also possible, but currently the state of the regulation is that autonomous vehicles aren't really plying on public streets yet, just yet. So you'll have to kind of be in the car while doing that. So instead of, you know, that experience, we just made a decision that the order of deployment should be wherever there is no regulatory hurdles, we should start there. So we have about a 600 plus list of people already who are pre-registered who want to get their cars fitted. And approximately 30 sites already mapped in the DC Baltimore region. We also have a brand new smart urban development called the Merriweather District. Almost 4.9 million square feet is going to be developed in the next couple of years. And that will also feature autonomous parking zones and is, you know, future ready. So our vehicles will be plying there. So we are currently in the process of narrowing down the set of beta test customers whose vehicles will be running in these areas. What we're also doing is first and foremost, we're looking for open surface parking lots that are tied to a commercial place of interest. Somewhere where people want to go with a high frequency. But the sheer act of looking for parking, finding convenient spots, and then walking for 15 plus minutes to get to the door is really a bother.
Yeah, like a shopping center during the holidays, for instance, is probably the best example, right?
Yes, exactly. Or even your place of work where you have large corporate campuses. And if you arrive, I used to work for a very large employer. And if you arrived after 8:30 in the morning, you were parked in the 17th row. And you spent a good, you know, 16 minutes. Forgive me for the specificity, but it really scarred my mind. So you would spend a good 16 minutes walking in the hot sun, getting just to the building, and you're not even at your desk. So this is time lost. Really, you didn't give your family and you didn't give your work. It's really wasted time. And on an average, a person spends about 108 hours a year just walking from where your car is parked to your building. That's just, you know, I happen to know that weird statistic, but that's a 16-day vacation. Can you imagine that? It's a 16-day vacation you did not give yourself. So what we're looking for is, you know, what comes with early deployment is we are starting to get our ecosystem going with these beta customers and their vehicles, but also these beta points of interest, where really it's in the benefit of the parking asset owners also, because now they have space savings, they have better, you know, utilization of inconvenient areas, underutilized areas of their lot. It's a lot greener because it's less concrete per vehicle. You're in short of making new land, you're increasing the amount of vehicles that can park in the same area. And even for planning purposes and smart cities, it's really a much, much better usage model for parking, right?
So have you started to develop some of these partnerships? So what are some of the first ones you've done?
So some of the first ones we've done is the Baltimore-Washington International Airport. We would like to offer, an option for business travelers, high-frequency travelers, and others, and everybody, frankly, who would like to make their experience much smoother. You know, you come to the airport and your car goes and parks itself. You use curbside checking to kind of check in, and now your vacation starts there. The Howard Hughes Corporation is a Fortune 500 company, and they build smart communities all over the US. They have some 13 marquee properties, and they have one right here in Columbia. And they've been an early partner, actually, and a wonderful partner at that. And we are testing our deployments in their newly constructed Merriweather District. We have 30 places in this region where the ecosystem partners really want the technology. They cannot wait. And really for hardly any upfront cost to them, they are able to achieve efficiency, space savings. Now, if you are a parking lot that charges daily charges for parking, and you could increase the space in your parking lot by 20%, that's 20% more revenue for you. I mean, do you need any other reason beyond that? So it's been very, the response has been enthusiastic.
Since this is all going to be automated, could it open up ways for new parking, like new ways of parking? For instance, like a little elevator thing that would stack the cars up as they go in and out, and it just brings the cars back, a conveyor system, who knows what? Does the nature of parking itself potentially change because of this?
Potentially, yes, it does. I mean, there are stacking systems in existence today. If you go to the New Yorks and the Chicago parking garages, they have some very sophisticated robotic systems that are stacking hundreds and thousands of vehicles in there. But you still need humans to operate those. What this technology can do is actually give you more freedom than that, because now you don't need that level of infrastructure, you know, investment, number one. But number two, the automation technology and the intelligence is on the car, not on the infrastructure. And because of which, everywhere that car goes, the intelligence and the automation goes with it. So you can scale the ecosystem a lot faster. And you can create, instead of creating a smart garage, think smart community, smart cities, you know, smart ecosystems. So right from your parks and recreation areas that are not really garages or whatever, even there, you know, because these cars are traveling everywhere, and restaurants, where a restaurant owner will not put this kind of equipment in there, but everybody is able to dabble into this ecosystem. And we are thinking bigger than one or two structures. We are thinking at a much higher level, you know, level of communities and level of cities. And that really is the power that this brings. If you think about endpoint connectivity and knowing the intent, the mission of the traveler, which is actually absent in your connected vehicles of today. Connected vehicles only will tell you, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. Connected automated vehicles will tell you, I'm here now, I'm going there. That's my mission, my end goal. So you know the intent. And that allows, that data allows the opportunity to really refine the experience of the customer. You know, you can think about offering some very specialty coupons, like a Starbucks coupon, because you know the driver is driving to the mall and is going to be entering from a particular entrance, and the Starbucks happens to be at that entrance, not the other entrance. And so very well timed, as the highest engagement with your app, when the person is using the app and parking their car. At that point, you're able to access the customer's undivided attention, and you're able to deliver. So it's a new marketing channel, new marketing potential. It's the ability to create a very, very highly refined and highly luxurious, smooth, streamlined experiences for the customer, and also streamlined, smooth delivery mechanisms for commercial establishments.
I think what's very interesting here is that, especially when you consider the smart community part, is that it says, you know, even with car ownership, we can start to still take advantage of some of the things that autonomous technology can do for the community. How do you see that unfolding?
That's what excites me so much about this technology. It's an enabler of societal change. It's an enabler that will shift mobility patterns and people's decision making based on, you know, having this capability in hand. Imagine train stations, imagine a commuter, and imagine you live in a neighborhood from where it's probably just the same if you hopped on a train. So for example, in most of the Maryland population lives and works and commutes going down to DC. And we live in places where it's either just the same to drive down to DC, or you hop on a train and go down to DC. And the difference really is in the efficiency. So at times of the day when there's more traffic on the road, people hop on the trains. And sometimes, you know, trains get crowded. The parking lots are overutilized. People sometimes will abandon their cars on the side of the street or double park illegally just because they need to jump on a train. Can you imagine the shift in these mobility patterns when people say, when I get there, I hop off and I hop on my train because I don't need to go park this car. I'm saving that extra time and the uncertainty associated with when and where am I going to get to park. And that just that one last mile change can actually make or break and swing the decision of how that person would commute. It actually takes congestion off of our roads and gets more people to ride in this multimodal transit system. And actually, it makes your transit systems also more efficient because increased ridership. So in fact, STIHR won a pilot from USDOT at the MARC train station, the Maryland Regional Commuter Train that goes down to DC. We are going to show what effect does this have on space savings, what effect does it have on increased ridership and more efficiency, and also safety. You know, people sometimes will choose to drive rather than take a train because the time that they come back home, it's unsafe to be walking on these empty, dark parking lots, especially, you know, if you're 120-pound petite woman and, you know, you feel vulnerable. And now if they are in a well-lit area just outside the train station where your car comes to pick you up, it's a no-brainer. Now you can really maximize your efficiency, save on gas, save on travel time, and really impact mobility patterns in a different way.
One of the interesting things I think about your technology is that you can take the car that you drive today and actually add this system in. Now, how does that work?
It's very, very simple. You have to have a vehicle that's 2012, 13 or newer, because we are looking for certain underlying, as I mentioned, there have to be certain underlying conditions that need to be met. So the cars need to have drive-by-wire. So if you have power steering, electronic throttle control, electronic braking, then you're pretty much there. Have, you know, radars and ultrasonic sensors already equipped on your car. Say if you have cruise control, adaptive cruise control, or some form of parking sensors on your car, then you know you already have those sensors. So the lesser we have to add on, the faster it is to deploying the kit on your car. And it's a small kit, the size of a sandwich box. Plug and play, all the connectors, wiring harness, everything comes with it. It gets installed in your vehicle and that's it. You turn it on and the system self-calibrates. It securely connects to your phone app and you do a registration process and you're all set and ready to roll. The STIHR network is a collection of several data points where the car already knows where the matching HAV zones are and can drive itself and navigate and park itself. So if you're driving by, it will prompt you and say, you know, there's an HAV parking zone over here. Would you like to drive there instead? We also have, what is called a mapping utility that anybody can basically download, and we can use that to crowdsource our maps. So if there's a place that you visit frequently, you can turn your car into mapping mode and you can drive through that place and the car will learn the route. And it's going to upload it to the STIHR server. And, you know, after some sanity checks and all of that, it actually gets published to everybody else. And now other people driving there will get to use that route. So that's how the points of interest network spreads.
Well, it seems that you could almost say, I'm home right now. I'd like to park at this shopping center that's a mile away. Take me there and park my car. What's stopping someone from actually doing that?
So that's a great question. So yes, there are safety checks and balances in the system that are pre-built. There is a very tight geofence around where the app is and where the car is. So a mile would be too large a distance for the app to say, oh, I'm here, but I would like to the car to go park there. And again, like I mentioned, regulation currently does not allow public streets. And if you're crossing public streets or even a highway in that mile to get to the, it would never be possible to set something like that, at least not in our technology currently.
So I would imagine then, for instance, you don't have to deal with navigating a four-way stop or traffic lights, that type of thing?
So we are narrowing down the problem, but you don't have to deal with traffic lights, but you do have to navigate a four-way intersection. Parking lots are very complicated places of very intense activity. For example, if you're navigating a parking lot you do come across intersecting lanes where you're turning left and getting back into another lane to hunt for parking. And so those can be three-way or four-ways. And so you have to observe. So you have to be able to detect other pedestrians and people who are walking, because parking lots are zones where you have pedestrian traffic also along with vehicular traffic. So you have to be able to detect other vehicles, other human beings. You have to be able to negotiate intersections. You have to be able to read signs, because there are speed limit signs. There are also stop signs. Sometimes there are signs painted on the ground. There are hashed lines. And so, yes, you have to do a lot of very complicated things in parking lots. Plus, if you compare and contrast a parking maneuver with, say, highway autopilot, you're literally driving straight. You're never going reverse on a highway. Your angle is limited. Your steering angle is kind of plus minus 30 degrees, you know, because your lanes, you have to maintain lane. So maintaining lateral and longitudinal stability and your speed control are really the biggest things in highway autopilot, and avoiding collision with an object in front of you. Whereas in a parking lot, as you know, there are some very crazy angles you have to negotiate, and some curbs and making U-turns, reverses, and all these angles. So it's the maneuvers are extremely complicated.
And it's going to be a lot different than for a Ford F-150 than it's going to be for a little Prius. So your system has to know the type of vehicle, its envelope, its ability to turn, turning radius, I would imagine. All those come into setting it up.
Yes, exactly. The self-calibration, like I know who I am, and I am a Ford F-150 versus I am a Toyota Prius. It's very, very important. And the car needs to know that in order to even decide whether is this spot suitable for me or not. Driving and negotiating those parking lanes, which are very, very tight. And not to mention people are pulling in and out of their spaces. So somebody's backing out, somebody's pulling in. People are very anxious, by the way, if you think about psychologically what people's mindset is in parking lots, your entire journey is over, the fun of driving is over, and now you have to get into what you're getting next, but you're just still looking for a spot.
Yeah, there's no rules, right? It's not like the open road where, you know, stay in your lane, turn your turn signal. In a parking lot, it's the wild, wild west.
It is the wild, wild west. It is. You said it exactly. It is the wild, wild west. People have no respect for anything. They're just rushing. They drove very well. Even decent drivers who drove the entire journey very well now are aggressive in parking lots. The National Safety Council released some numbers and I was looking at them. It's very interesting that almost 38% of the people think it's okay to text and drive if you're doing it in the parking lot, but not on the street. 60% of people use their phones in parking lots when they're driving. Just in 2017 alone, it says 580 deaths in parking lots.
I'll give you a scenario. You go down the aisle, you see the spot, but you've gone just a little bit past it, and the guy behind you is right on top of you because he doesn't want you to back up, and he knows you can't pull into that spot. How in the world is an autonomous system going to be able to handle crazy situation like that? Or would two cars, your autonomous car and a human-driven one, both try to go into the same spot at the same time? And the human-driven car, of course, lays on the horn to try and get you out of the way. How are you going to handle those situations?
So I have to say that's a very, very, very realistic situation. And I can completely see that unfolding in front of me. And those situations can get very aggressive. I mean, people get very aggressive in parking lots, especially holiday times and other times. And I have myself been in situations where I tried to back up and the person behind me is like closing the gap. I'm like, come on. It was my spot first.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw it first. And he's like, he's giving me eyeballs saying, no, you crossed it or whatever.
So do you have a special AI routine that's going to handle that? The aggressive driver routine or something?
So these cars are built to follow rules. And they are built with maximizing other people's safety. So because this is a true driverless vehicle and there is no passenger inside, it is meant to operate. Again, back to the concept of narrowing your domain, you know, in problem solving. This is a true driverless. This is not an autopilot where a person is in the car, where there are people in the car and you're driving on the highway. This is a true driverless technology where people alight from the vehicle and the car is going driverless. So this vehicle is maximized to always create a safe environment for other people. And if it needs to self-sacrifice, it will self-sacrifice if it needs to. But given that proposition and always following the rules, what it's going to do when it detects a spot like that, is it's going to try to back in. It's going to show its indicators that, you know, look, I'm backing in. His left turning is, the car's left turning is on. If the spot is on the left, you're backing up. Now, if the car behind you is more aggressive and he won't let you go or he sticks his ground, this car is going to start backing up. And then it's going to pause and it's going to wait for the other car to kind of move behind, you know, gentleman mode. And if that car doesn't, it's going to pause and give it 3 seconds. And if it doesn't, then the car is basically going to say, okay, I can't execute this mission, recalculate, and it's going to go move to find another parking spot. So it's going to be a very non-aggressive approach. If it started reversing and the other guy jumped to your spot and actually kind of, because our car backs in, so it'll actually go ahead of the spot and back in. But if you go ahead and the other guy jumped your spot and actually went in, as you start backing in, you realize immediately, this is not a spot anymore. It's taken. So again, it's going to say mission recalculate. It's going to abort that mission and it's going to again rejoin the path to search for the next available spot and it's going to go around. The good thing is, since a human is not in the car, it's not wasting anybody's time, right? So this car can actually go and look for another spot because the customer is actually in the mall shopping and better utilizing their time. So again, it's not adding any extra frustration to anybody. It gives priority to a human being in another car to take that spot, which is fine. And it's going to go find another spot. So it really, really, you know, value maximization for the ecosystem.
And I think you've hit it right. Is that, hey, I've got all the time in the world. If you don't want to move, I can wait. It'd be interesting. You could probably put a little dial on the app that says, how courteous do you want your parking car to be, right?
Alec Baldwin mode.
How do you test for all this, these types of things? How do you know when the system is up and ready to go?
We are very, very big into actual scenarios, scenario planning, scenario setup, and scenario execution. We have a very nice field testing team that is dedicated for this purpose. And every day they're cooking up scenarios and they're going out there and these cars are actually performing these actions. Desktop simulations have its place in early development and to be able to calibrate your control algorithms and all of that and refine that. But really, when rubber meets the road when you're really doing this in the real world, because there are so many parameters, like this jumpy, you know, people behind you and aggressive drivers and very, very uncontrolled environments where you cannot really plan. So we believe in actually, you know, executing these scenarios in practice. And we have 8 test sites with varying topologies, with varying landscape, all parking lot and private road, vertical garage structures, sloping garages, fast pullout garages, open surface lots on an incline, semi-covered, underground, various different approaches, very busy intersections, joints in there, islands in the middle of parking lot. And we are constantly testing because I can promise you this from my experience, no 2 days for the same test are alike, just even because of the weather. And by virtue of being in Maryland, we have the gift of horrible weather. So we have ice, rain, slush.
What a great gift.
I know. What a great, absolutely what a great gift. We have slush, black ice, sleet, snow, rain, slush mix, wintry, icy mix, all of that. So this car has actually been through some tremendous diversity in weather and lighting. And I actually have videos where the car was actually driving and executing its maneuver in almost 1.5 inches of snow covered on the ground, and you cannot see a single line. You don't know where the parking spots start and where they end, and none of that. And the car was yet able to drive through. It adjusted itself to the change in the friction with the road and pumping brakes instead of slamming them and finding a spot between 2 vehicles, determining that, okay, this is a parking spot and not a curb, or and even though it can't see lines anymore, and it kind of maneuvered itself in there. So really, for all that we are and we have, I am very thankful that we're able to build a very robust technology because of that. We don't need sunny and balmy weather 300 days a year in order to run our tests there. So it's more realistic and practical.
So how do you see what you're doing at Steer evolving as this whole world of autonomy and autonomous mobility as a service starts to become more of a reality? What's next for Steer? What's that next problem that you think you could solve with the building blocks that you have?
So I think parking has itself has a long way to go. I'm in full agreement that in the next 40 years, the city planning, cities are going to look very different and parking structures will start going away eventually and make room for more livable spaces that people can tend to use as autonomous vehicles start rolling in and these cars can go park itself. Because otherwise, it's not a value proposition for people if they have to go park their car half a mile away and then take a shuttle bus and come back to where they need to go. It's not very convenient. And then you're going to see people buying stuff online more and more, and we cease to become human beings who really go out and live and enjoy our communities and build communities. We're going to be desktop citizens.
Well, yeah, and the shuttle is actually, you know, we hear a lot about autonomous shuttles, but it is a shuttle. It is on a schedule. It completely eliminates the big advantage you've been talking about is, hey, drop me off exactly where I want to go and go park and then come back and get me when I'm ready.
Even if it's an autonomous shuttle, it adds overall additional time to your journey. And so in the near term, this technology will help you close that gap. It's a very different modality than any of the mobility as a service models that you're seeing currently because you use your own vehicle. So that convenience factor cannot really be overstated. And sometimes you have stuff to carry. You have things in your car. I mean, it's not very easy to hop off and get onto public transportation for everybody. Over time, as you grow, and I mentioned this ecosystem, and by putting this technology in place today, because it can, and it is capable and ready to be used today, you're activating the entire ecosystem. You're activating the ecosystem with consumers, with producers, with resource owners, with data generators, data consumers. And as this ecosystem grows, the amount of different things we can do and harvest really the capabilities of this ecosystem to further refine the experience of the consumers and also the producers and also the asset providers. Over time, as other autonomous vehicle technologies and, you know, the level 4, level 5s come in, those cars will also need to be parked. So now, because the ecosystem is already rich and already started producing and already started maturing, those cars can just plug in. And they can harvest and they can start operating in this ecosystem. So it's not, so the Steer ecosystem lives on and it kind of becomes a legacy system there that others in the next decades, as they start rolling in, they can just join. They have a network and an ecosystem ready to partake in.
There's so many times where I would have loved to have just driven my rental car right to the gate and say, hey, Hertz, come get it. It's ready to go. Have you thought about using it in that way, like working with the rental car companies at airports, for instance, to make it easier for you to pick up and drop off your car?
Yes. As a matter of fact, at the BWI airport, we are actually designing a two-phase approach where in the first phase, the rental car company actually is going to use this technology for in-yard vehicle operational efficiency. And so that when these cars are returned by customers, you know, they, depending on what is required, you know, the cars go into the service line or they go into the car wash line or they go back to the ready line so that there's less time spent in yard and more time our cars moving back out to service customers. And the second phase actually is to be able to allow customers to drop off and pick themselves up at the airport. And from the rental car lot, the car comes there to pick them up. And again, when you return your car, you don't have to go back to the rental car facility, return it, hop on a shuttle and get to the airport. You drop yourself off and the car takes care of itself. You know, this again, that richer experience for the customer is in the plans. And there are a few hurdles to overcome there with, like I said, which what kind of streets would you cross to do that? When can we do that? Really, it's sky's the limit on what you can do.
Imagine now my vehicle is suitable, right? It has drive-by-wire and all that. And I get on your waiting list. It sounds like you've got quite a waiting list there. I think you said like 600 people. How long, if I want one of those, I want one tomorrow. How long am I going to have to wait to get one for my vehicle?
So my take on that is, yes, there is a long wait list. But again, for the right, if you have the right vehicle and they qualify, then you're going to move very quickly up that chain. For the level 4 automated valet parking, we are kind of trying to ensure a great overall experience. So we are sourcing people by geographies so that in certain geographies, there is a higher density of points of interest where they can do this and use the service. So we are trying to kind of match up the people in those geographies first. And then looking at where the next interest areas are and how many people have signed up from another area and, you know, where the hot pockets of activity are, we would love to kind of start bringing those people in and getting their cars outfitted, and at the same time really populating and creating that point of interest ecosystem around them. So, you know, both need to move lockstep in order for people to be able to use the technology. And if that means reaching out to the major popular attractions and places of use, you know, your Walmarts, your Targets, your CVSs, your airports, so be it. And also, you know, getting your customers to tell you. The voice of the customer is so important, you know, and you can collect information from them about where they would like to, where they frequently go and where they would like to see the time savings, and let that drive the strategy also. So there we have a two-pronged approach in how we are, you know, growing.
Well, I hope that Boston's on your list, because I'd love to give your system a try. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us on Future Car Podcast. I think this is going to be a really, really interesting discussion for our listeners.
Well, first of all, I have to say thank you, Ed, for the opportunity to speak with you and to your listeners. I'm really fascinated by Siemens, and I have a long history of Siemens in my family. So it runs in the blood, as I would say. But thank you for the opportunity. And yes, I can go on and on for days talking on this. So this is my favorite subject to talk on. So thank you for the opportunity. Well,
yes, and maybe if you could just take a minute, but is it your grandfather or grandmother or someone worked for Siemens, I think, way back? Is that right?
Yes, I am a third generation Siemens employee myself. So my grandfather, my mom's dad, worked for Siemens from 1954 to 1973.
What did he do for Siemens?
So he was actually in charge of erecting all the factories, the sugar factories that Siemens was installing in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s in India, in Chennai, Rourkela, and everywhere. So in fact, he was he went by chairman, was his designation. So he held a very important position and did a lot of the early work in erecting all those factories that Siemens was putting together. And then after him, his son went on to join the company and rose up the ranks. His son started, you know, pretty low and worked through and rose up the ranks, my mother's brother. And he retired finally at Siemens. And, you know, an entire career spent at Siemens. And just before he retired, he kind of plugged me in as an intern. And so I worked there for a year on distributed control systems for their oil refinery that they were putting together in New Bombay. And so I worked there for a year, after which then I moved to the United States. Third generation, you know, Siemens runs in the blood.
Well, and here you are talking to Siemens again. It's almost destiny, right?
Yes, it absolutely is.